my heart and your light will show up.
Today is Wednesday, March 11th, 2015. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing, and we are going to start with an informational meeting on affordable housing. Great topic. We're really excited. I want to call up Bill Hall, Commissioner for Lincoln County, Martha McLennan, Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives, and Martha Olmsted from the Community Action Team in St. Helens. And we have approximately 50 minutes for five of you, three subsequent panels, so roughly 10 minutes each.
Oh, no, there are seven.
Seven. Yeah. Okay, maybe a little less than 10 minutes each if we want to have time for question and answer.
Right. Good afternoon, and thank you. My name is Bill Hall. I'm a commissioner from Lincoln County, and I'm very pleased to be here representing the Housing Alliance. And just thought I'd start off by letting you know, who is the Housing Alliance? We are a coalition of more than 60 organizations from all parts of this state. Our members have come together with the knowledge that housing opportunity really is the base on which all of our success is built. That's individual success as students, parents, workers, community members, as well as the success of our communities. We represent a diverse set of voices, from residents to local jurisdictions, nonprofit housing developers, and all kinds of organizations working to meet basic human needs. Our takeaway message today: Oregon communities will not succeed without safe, decent, and affordable housing that offers a range of options for residents. Our communities across the state are falling short of meeting housing needs. The Oregon Housing Alliance annually compiles information on how our housing costs compare to what residents earn. We've uploaded all of these into OLIS for you today, and I'd encourage you to look at the sheets for the counties that you represent. Here's one of them, a very quick data sheet that compares wages to the costs of rent, the costs of home ownership, and it tells a very troubling story for every county in Oregon. What we see is that for our elderly, for service workers, even for many earning higher wages, the cost of housing is out of reach. But there are solutions, great and small, and I'm going to go off script very quickly to put in a quick plug for House Bill 3082, one of the bills that you've got scheduled for a hearing later today. It's addressing a very small fix to the property tax exemption used by nonprofit organizations providing affordable housing. The reason I want to do that is because in addition to the three metro counties, my county, Lincoln County, is the only other jurisdiction right now taking advantage of that authority. But back to the challenges. Local governments are being creative around the state, and they're using local resources. Let me talk just quickly about the challenges in Lincoln County. The Central Coast, as you probably already know, it's a pretty popular tourist destination. A lot of the jobs in tourism are low wage and seasonal. Vacation and rental homes are in high demand. About 25% of our housing stock right now is in vacation rentals and retirement homes. We do have some less expensive housing stock, but that is the housing that is generally in the poorest condition. I could throw numbers at you all afternoon, but I know our time is limited. And the key number for me is that in Lincoln County, and again, I know this is mirrored in a lot of other communities around the state, between 1990 and 2010, price of housing grew exactly twice as fast as wages did. People can't afford to live where they work. Businesses in our county have trouble recruiting and retaining workers, and that's not just service workers. It's professional positions as well. Some of the things we've done is developing a comprehensive homelessness and housing plan. We've created a community land trust. We've joined the Housing Alliance. Our county and many of our cities have provided financial support to the land trust. We've set up small revolving loan funds for affordable housing development, done workforce housing needs studies. But we're just starting to move the needle on this huge need. Joining me today are several speakers who are going to be sharing information on the tools we have, the needs we face, and the tools and resources that we need. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to be here today and to thank you for your service to the people of Oregon.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're an affordable housing provider headquartered in Milwaukee, but we provide housing in 16 Oregon counties. In Clackamas County, we're also a homeless service provider, providing emergency shelter for families experiencing homelessness and eviction prevention and rapid rehousing to families, singles, seniors, vets, and most recently, folks in recovery from mental illness. My task today is to give you a very, very fast primer on the Affordable Housing Toolkit. Helping you to understand how the state's funds fit into the other funds that combine together to create affordable housing. So public funding for affordable housing is delivered in three different kinds of tools. Money to cover construction costs, which is equity. Support to create less expensive financing, so bringing the cost of debt down, and resources that make it less expensive to operate. Typical projects use multiple sources from both public and private sources. Some things in Oregon's toolkit include the document recording fee, the Housing Trust Fund, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit that works on the debt side, and the property tax exemption that works to reduce the operating expenses. These Oregon sources are combined with federal sources, most notably the federal low-income housing tax credit, local sources such as waived fees or donated land, and private sources. Depending on the mix of sources, different levels of affordability can be achieved. So I've provided you with a one-page kind of handout that illustrates four different projects around the state and the blend of sources. The thing that you'll see here is that the underlying sources are sources that are Oregon money. The trust fund, weatherization dollars, Oregon affordable housing tax credits, preservation funding from lottery-backed bonds. But you can see also that there are just a wide variety of other sources and individual deals, and they address different aspects of the deal, either that equity piece, that debt piece, or that operations piece. The combination can also achieve different levels of affordability. And you can see when you have rent subsidies, for example, in Hollyfield Village and Lake Oswego, you can get to households below 30% of the area median income. When you don't have that rent subsidy, for example, in Alma Gardens in Hillsborough, you're really looking more at 50% of median income. And just I feel like I ought to print business cards for you all that have the area median income on them. I ought to do it for myself. But just to give you a quick snapshot, 30% of median income right now statewide is $13,150 a year for a family of one, $16,900 a year for a family of three. The 50th percentile, a little higher, $21,900 for a single person, $28,150 for a family of three. So you get a sense of the order of magnitude. In affordable housing, the goal is to have people pay no more than 30% of their income towards their rent and utilities. That would mean they would have enough money to spend on other things that they might need, food, medicine, education, transportation, all of the other necessities of life. The examples that I've given you here really are on the rental housing side of the continuum, but the same kind of dynamic works in much the same way in home ownership. If you think of your own home, you know you have some equity, you probably have debt, and then you may have operating expenses that you're paying for. In the affordable side of home ownership, the equity comes from things like down payment assistance programs. And again, those might come from the state through the individual development account program, where folks are saving their own money matched with state resources to make a down payment to buy a home. Debt might come from the state mortgage revenue bond program for first-time home buyers or the veterans program for home buyers. And then operating support can come from programs, again, on the tax exemption side, but also things like energy cost savings or help to pay for energy bills. The real message here is that the public sources that we have, though we have lots of them, and they do add up to an order of magnitude that's fairly large, they're very oversubscribed. Typically, they're oversubscribed by about 3-1. That means that there is a project sponsor who has identified land, who has started working on that project, and is trying to get that funding. But it may take them 2 or 3 years by the time they go to all the different funding sources that they need in the right sequence and kind of get to the point where they get that package put together and are able to build the property. We also right now have record low vacancy rates and record high increases in Oregon. So the problem as we come out of the recession is worse. While we do have more people employed, wages are low, the fact that there was a lack of building for 5 years meant that there was kind of a backlog, and the boom of building we've seen is really at the higher end of the market level. That brings the rental prices up in the rest of the market. It heats that market up, and it increases the competition. Average vacancy rates in the state right now, about 3%. 2% vacancy rate means that you have just enough time to clean the carpets, clean the drapes, maybe move a new refrigerator in if the old one needs to be replaced, and you occupy that unit again. In some communities like Bend right now, they have like a point something vacancy rate. Astronomically low. In my portfolio, so about 1,800 units statewide, we have a vacancy rate of 1.6 in 2014. So in this session, you're going to see bills that address various pieces of various types of tools. There is a request for increased funding for the emergency homeless account. There is request funding for foreclosure counseling, adjustment to some of the property tax exemption statutes, and a request for new significant capital equity sources using general obligation bonds. Each tool in this kit is important. We need them all. As we strive to meet the needs of Oregonians who are unstably housed or who pay too much of their income for rent or who are preparing to move on to market rate rentals or home ownership, keeping that continuum flowing so that people can move along. As you consider the various ways that you can help to address the affordable housing needs in your communities and across the state, I want to assure you that the partners that work in the affordable housing delivery system, from the for-profit and nonprofit developers, the housing authorities, homeless service providers, foreclosure counselors, we are all ready to redouble our efforts and use any additional appropriations so that they will be spent wisely and effectively to meet those needs. So with that, I would answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon. I don't have numbers, I don't have flyers, but I do have a really awesome story because I am on the other aspect of what they do.
Can you say your name for the record?
Yes, sorry. My name is Martha Olmsted and I work at Community Action Team for Columbia County. And I wear many hats throughout the day depending on who walks through my door. So we do a transitional housing, permanent housing, we do... You name it, we got it, depending on the crisis that when people walk in. But about 3 years ago, we started working with this individual, and when I talked to her, she was very, very emotional when I told her I was going to share her story, because her story is really unique to us, because when she came to our office 3 years ago, she picked any apartment she wanted, because it was apartments for her to go and pick. It was scattered site. Go pick a place. Go find a place to live. She was able to find it within a week. She moved into her own apartment. We paid, we subsidized, we paid according to her income, which she had none. We subsidized until she was able to find employment, which she couldn't find employment because she was always in and out of jail, in and out of recovery. This individual had so many barriers that it was very hard, but with time, with patience, we were able to help her get through all those barriers. Slowly after time, she started to volunteer at one of our partner agencies. Soon after that, she became a full-time employee. After being a full-time employee, she started paying all her debts. She got off probation. She started being a really good person in our community that she believed in herself. But it took time, and it took people that believe in her to say, look, you can do this. And she started paying all her fines, no longer on probation, pay off her child's support. And then 3 years later, she said, I have $4,000 in my savings account. We taught her how to live within her means. Not to depend on the government, not to depend on anybody else, not to depend on our agency, because I don't know if tomorrow we're going to have funding, but depend on her own and her own will to do this. A lot of counseling, a lot of budgeting, a lot of trial and error. We did it, and she did it herself. But if she were to walk through my doors today, you know what I would give her? A tent and a tarp. Because there's nothing available in our county right now. That percentage that you were saying that there's 1% emptiness, we're always waiting on the landlord knocking on the door. Are you done steam cleaning the carpets? Because we want it. We want it for our clients. That's us advocating for our clients. That's how desperate we need affordable housing. Because when our clients are on a fixed income, it's very hard for them to make ends meet. And this is a landlord's market nowadays. When the landlords are setting the prices for their rent, when they're saying, you know what, this is my time to make money off the property. So sometimes if your income is $720, $760, and it's a one bedroom, they're charging $850 in rent. So for somebody on a fixed income, whether you're a senior or a person with disabilities, you're not going to get into any place. You're not. It's impossible. So for my gal that had been on my program for 3 years, that has finally graduated and finally made it, she came back, and we went and graduated out of the program, and we went and looked at her house one final time, which I had never been in her house. And literally, she does have river view. She has a $1 million view because she lives but right by the Columbia River. Everything that she purchased from her for her house is from the store that she works at, the thrift store. Everything, $1.50, everything that I pointed at, she said, oh, that cost me $2. That cost me $1.50. Why? Because she took pride in owning her home, her very own home. Those things belong to her. So when you guys think about, you know, where does EHA money, you know, the homeless money goes to? It goes to the individuals. It goes to the case managers, to us, to make those things happen for our families that are in crisis, for the families that are struggling with mental illness, that are struggling with drugs and alcohol, who are struggling to just make ends meet. A paycheck, you know, it doesn't work. So it takes more than that. So, like I said, I don't have numbers. I don't have, but I have stories. Stories that will melt your heart, that will make you cry. And that story did make me cry when I went and I looked at her house because I couldn't believe it. I said, you know what? This could be a good housekeeping magazine home. And she said, what? I said, your house, we can put it in good housekeeping magazine. And she goes, no way. I said, yes. So she let me take pictures. So next time I come over, I'll bring you pictures of it because you'll see it can happen. So thank you.
Thank you so much. It's great to have people come from all different parts of the state.
Right.
Problems all over. One question from Representative Gallegos.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I want to, Ms. Olmstead, I want to thank you for your testimony. So, you know, sometimes numbers are fine, but I think passion is also equally important. And I want to just acknowledge that the Community Action Team has done a wonderful job in terms of housing for the last 10, 15, 20 years. And want you to keep up that work. I would also say that you know, I just struggle with this whole issue. It's like it's so simple that our whole economic development, the health of our workforce, all depends on adequate housing, stable housing. And without that, none of these other pieces that we're trying to fix are going to get fixed. So thank you all for your work, and I do want to commend the housing, affordable housing community, the, as you said, the private and the nonprofit, for working together and really working toward fixing this issue that is statewide. So thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. I'd like to call up the next panel, Maxine Fitzpatrick, Executive Director of Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives, and Justin Burry, Deputy Director of Community Alliance of Tenants.
First of all, I have to apologize for Maxine. She wasn't feeling well, so she was unable to make it today.
And so, Kim, before you start, if I can also apologize, I have to go testify in the next room on a bill, so I'm going to leave this in the capable hands of my vice chair.
All right, thank you.
And I will be listening to your testimony later. It's all being archived, so I'm sorry to miss it in person.
Okay.
Thank you for being here.
So first of all, my name is Debbie Christensen, and I do work with PCRI, which is Portland Community Reinvestment Initiatives. And I am filling in, like I said, for Maxine Fitzpatrick, who was not feeling well. She's the executive director of PCRI. We're here today because PCRI has invested, has reinvested, basically, as it's called, in Portland, in the north, northeast Portland. And we are... We're investing in the neighborhoods and in our families in the neighborhood. We're trying to preserve the diversity and provide tools to help low-income Portland families and individuals to achieve stability and self-sufficiency. And I am very honored to be here today with you today. PCRI provides over 700 units of affordable housing. We have a very different portfolio. We have single-family homes and small plexes. So our units are a different mix. We don't have large complexes. We have small, so it's a little bit more of a personalized community. And we'd like to focus right now on the importance of building stability for those families. So our rental units at PCRI, we also have been working to turn those into home ownerships. We have the renters that we have there work with our programs and become homeowners, because home ownership is such a big part of being stable and being able to have children and have their children be educated and be able to have stable jobs and careers. And we support and fund new home buyers and assist them in obtaining home ownership, many of whom are elderly and they're able to stay in their homes. We also have a program where we are able to support those who currently are homeowners to be able to maintain their homes and be able to keep their homes through our home retention program. We know that the most reliable indicator of whether a family will rise out of poverty or not is whether or not they have a stable home and if they're able to hopefully own a home. And when we are able to work with our rental families and assist them in transitioning from their rental housing to home ownership, they then contribute to the local communities, and also they build financial strength. Their children are more stable and they succeed better in school. For most Oregonians, home ownership is primarily and often the only way that they can build wealth in their families, and they can use that equity to help establish life goals such as starting or growing a business, their children's educations, and saving for their stable retirement. I also want to emphasize that the tremendous value of supporting low-income homeowners in retaining their homes through the small investments in home repairs, weatherization, and tax and estate planning. PCRI's service area is mostly the north and northeast Portland area. These homeowners are at high risk, and many of them are elderly and have been able to buy homes in this area. We really do try to keep them in their community that they want to be in. And right now, that community, the Portland community, is growing and becoming very expensive. And a lot of times, our residents are being pushed out of the area because they can no longer afford to live in those areas. So we want to be able to help them to be able to not only rent and become stable, but also move into home ownership. And I want to encourage you to continue to support the home ownership and the home and low-income homes for Portland, for Portland and Oregonians. And I want to thank you guys for all of your support and to thank you for letting me speak today.
Thank you as well. Mr. Burry.
Yes. Hi, my name is Justin Burry. I'm the Executive Director for the Community Alliance of Tenants. We are Oregon's only tenant-based grassroots tenants' rights organization with about over 1,000 members throughout the state, although we focus primarily in the Portland metro area. Our members are 90% or more low-income tenants, including seniors, veterans, people with disabilities, people of color, and working families. We work with tenants in a variety of ways. We operate one of the state's only renters' rights hotline, where we hear tenants that are having difficulties with protecting their rights with their landlords, be it with repairs or deposits or harassment, discrimination, or landlords entering their unit, for instance, without proper notice, and giving them helpful information and strategies as to how to address those challenges through self-advocacy and empowerment. And we also work with tenants in on the ground through our building-based organizing and the Safe Housing Project, where we will identify buildings that are facing severe habitability and repair issues and work with the tenants as a group to ensure that as they're working with their landlord to request those needed repair and maintenance issues, that they feel safe and stable and they're not singled out for retaliation or recriminations of any sort. And what we bring to the table with our work with the Housing Alliance, as well as the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, is the tenant perspective. You know, we hear tenants share their stories about the types of challenges they face and different barriers they face in their efforts to find and obtain and keep safe and stable and healthy, affordable housing. And, you know, what we find is that given the lack of affordable housing and the tight rental market, those challenges are exacerbated quite significantly. And so if you think about, you know, our main priorities are, for instance, the lack of evictions protections. And so tenants who are on a month-to-month lease or are at the end of their fixed-term lease can receive what they call a no-cause termination notice, which means they have to move out and they have no ability to try to fight that termination. And although many times I myself received one because a landlord was moving back into the house, which is a fairly good reason, sometimes those reasons are not quite fair, and they can be retaliatory or discriminatory in nature. And so what we find is that especially for low-income tenants who are seeking repairs, for instance, just the fact that that is a threat can prevent them from even addressing the issue with their landlord. Through some research that we did recently, through a telephone survey, we found that, you know, for the percentage of tenants that have received a no-cause termination in the past, they are less likely to try to ask for a repair or otherwise address an issue that's happening in their rental housing. And so that can lead to substandard housing because even if the landlord is a good landlord, and most are, the tenant, just by that simple fear of no-cause eviction, will censor and will choose not to address some of those issues, and so that can be harmful to both sides of the issue, both the landlord and the tenant, because the landlord is unable to see what kinds of repair issues are needed, and may have, you know, a leaky pipe that causes other damage down the road. And so it is the responsibility of the tenant to address these repair issues, although if they don't feel protected in actually addressing them, it can actually, the rights that they have are not actually enforceable, or they're able to address them. And so Why this matters in a tight rental market is because if there is no other opportunities on the other side, then that it makes the environment and the leverage that the landlord has over the tenant even more dire. And so if you know that the last time you looked for housing, it took you 2 or 3 or 4 months to find housing that is in your rent range, your income range, to make those applications, to hopefully get back a positive response, you may be competing for the same rental unit as 20 or 30 other renters, then that experience may prohibit you from actually feeling safe and secure in your current housing, and thus will limit your ability to actually protect the rights that you have. And so we find that this is not only an issue with asking for repairs and habitability issues, but it can also exacerbate other issues such as discrimination in terms of tenants trying to get into housing. We know that there are certain levels of types of discrimination that are illegal under the Fair Housing Act. Oftentimes they can be very difficult for the tenant themselves to identify and to document and to prove. And so oftentimes tenants who have, for instance, high barriers such as a credit history, say from like a past foreclosure or a medical emergency, they may choose not to even apply to certain housing because they don't believe that they are competitive enough to actually win it, given the high competition of any particular unit. And so discrimination is also also an issue, but we also see more rent increases because of the high vacancy rate or the low vacancy rate, excuse me. And those rent increases can lead to some of the displacement issues that my colleague to my left, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, was speaking of, that happens where PCRI operates, where you can see a historic community that was in, for instance, the north and northeast area, and then that area started to revitalize, and the rent increases that resulted displaced that community. And so you see that those challenges especially happening with communities of color and people with high barriers, people exiting the criminal justice system that are looking for a second chance, people who have been unemployed for maybe more than a year and don't have the correct employment history or the amount of savings in order to not only pay the deposit, but to succeed in the application process. Because a lot of times landlords ask for, you need 3 or 4 times rent in your income in order to qualify for this housing, even if they're willing to pay 50% of their rent of their income on rent, which is the case for a lot of our members. Mm-hmm. Some of our members are even spending 70% of their income on rent and having to make really difficult choices between providing transportation needs or food or medicine for their children. And when tenants have this kind of instability, whether it's the fear of a rent increase or an eviction or mold issues that are causing health issues in their home, then that can affect how they're able to educate their children, for instance. Children with asthma are much more likely to miss school. Or if they have to move, moving from one school to another can have really detrimental effects on a children's ability to be educated and for the parents' ability to support that education. And we hear many stories of tenants who have great jobs, but then they get a 30-day no-cost termination, and not only do they lose their housing, but they lose their job as well because they have to move so quickly, and so they have to skip their work in order to try to secure housing for their family. So you can see that given such a tight rental market and escalating rents, that the types of challenges that tenants face are so much more exacerbated. And so not only do we need investments in actual development of affordable housing, but we also need to look at tenant protections around some of the preemptions, such as inclusionary zoning or rent control or even the minimum wage, so tenants can make more money so we don't have to put as much investments in affordable housing. And looking at things like the ability for landlords to evict for no cause with no reason, and the tenant's lack of ability to address, even if there is a problem, that they can fix. And so I thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Questions? Representative Evans, and then Gallegos.
I have a comment and a request, so I'm not sure how it categorizes under question. But first of all, thank you for your testimony, and thanks to the folks who came up before. When it comes to housing, for good or for ill, I'm a creature of my own experience. And as a young city councilor in the 80s and a mayor in the 90s in a small college town, limited access or constraints upon housing for apartments and for temporary living was something I got to live through very firsthand. We actually formed something called the Monmouth Independence Tenants Union. And one of the things that has come about as a result of conversations really around the last couple weeks is I'd like at some point perhaps for the committee to look at a work group for a conversation that follows up on some ideas that were actually around the state in the 90s having to do with a rights and responsibilities statement where the renters and the rentees, almost like a 10-year plan where we don't care what the plan is, but we make sure that people sit down, are clear about what the expectations are for a safe place to live and what the expectations are for renters to be able to follow up on that. In a small college town, for example, the expectations of noise stopping at, you know, midnight and things like that might be different than in some other communities. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I think before we start massing resources and putting money into things, which I think we should, a clear understanding of where the line is and what the shared responsibility model is, putting it center stage, may actually help to bring about some of the other changes we're interested in. And I'd like to kind of invite folks that are interested in that. I'd like to volunteer for that if that's a possibility. So that's my request / comment. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that suggestion. I'm fairly new to this whole area, and I see John Van Lanningham in the audience who's doing a lot of that issue around manufactured homes, really getting people together who are both the owners and the renters. There's certainly some good models out there. There may be...
And if I may, John Van Lanningham and I participate in the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, and so I think we are really lucky here in Oregon to have a coalition like that where we can bring both sides together and kind of horse trade and identify some shared interests, because sometimes some issues that we're seeing is not necessarily an issue that the landlord is hating, you know. We just got some great legislation, or we're looking to get some great legislation around transparency around utility bills, for instance. And that was not necessarily something that the landlords gave them a lot of heartburn about. And so we do have a pretty unique situation that John Van Lanningham helped create in the 80s. You know, a little bit of my worry with that sometimes is that it doesn't give us as advocates sometimes the same opportunity to work with our legislators, because it kind of happens before the session begins, and we agree to an omnibus bill, and then we give it to the legislature, and they pass it because both sides agree to it. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I think we could maybe expand the conversation a little bit to include some of those other parties and look at some of those structural issues that maybe the landlord-tenant coalition can't come to consensus around, and see what kind of movement we can make.
Well, great suggestions, and you hear that volunteer offer. That's fantastic. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, thank you, and the Chair. Mr. Burry and Ms. Christensen, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You both mentioned some of the issues around discrimination and communities of color, mm-hmm. and I'm particularly interested in what we need to do in those areas. I remember some years ago seeing a national study that said that one of the findings was that as inner city housing was going down, many of the inner city folks, which are communities of color in most cases, or a lot of cases, were literally moving to suburbs, mm-hmm. going out. And then last spring, I attended a conference, and a demographer from Portland State, from the Center for Population Studies, had an interesting fact that apparently with the Albina and Alberta gentrification in Portland, that a lot of the African-American community has left. But what was interesting was that the higher income earners from that community were going to Vancouver. and the lower income were moving out to East Multnomah County. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, one of the things that made me think about is I think the legislature would be very appreciative and helped by some sort of return on investment kind of analysis that would help us to see that by losing those high-income folks, we're actually losing revenue in our state.
Right.
So how do we be, you know, really think about it in those terms and recognize that it's in our self-interest, it's in the interest of the state to maintain people who are a workforce that's really developing their income. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. And now I'd like to call up Margaret Van Vliet and Janet Byrd. Margaret from Oregon Housing Community Services and Janet from Neighborhood Partnerships.
No, that's great. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Van Vliet. I am the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Really glad to see you all again. I do have a few slides to show, and I think my job today is to really put a little bit more context around the department's role in the affordable housing development arena. So I've got a few slides I want to show you about that. But first, I want to provide a quick update about some other work that this committee, and in particular Representative Parrish, had spearheaded with the Affordability Balance and Choice Work Group, which you've been briefed on. There were two pieces that asked the department to do some of its work differently, and they manifested in a couple of bills. And so what I wanted to share with the committee today was that on two of these, we actually think there's steps that the department can take in partnership with either other agencies or its partners to address the underlying concerns. And so the first one has to do with application of what we've called a state housing lens. And in OLIS, you'll see a letter from myself and from Jim Rue, who's the Department of Land Conservation and Development, to Representative Parrish and Representative Reardon about some steps we're going to take proactively to march down the path that the ABC work group asked us to. And it's possible that in that process we'll discover some things that could be addressed in statute, and we'd like to report back on that. And then similarly, we think we've managed a fix to the cap problem that we've been experiencing with our partners on this Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. We did call together a work group. And so again, similarly, I think there's some steps that we can take to address the concerns that were raised in the ABC group. And so I wanted to provide that update, and I'm happy to come back and provide additional updates later in the session or to individual members if that's helpful. Okay, so with that, I will do the quick overview. And just for some of you, this is a bit of a reminder. I've used this graphic to explain the role of the state agency in this world of affordable housing finance and development. We are an intermediary. We are a public bank. We are not a developer or a landlord. We do not provide direct service. So all of our work really is through partners at the community level. And I think it's important to kind of come back to that point as well. The folks you heard from just a little bit ago are really the ones who do the work on the ground, and I think that's very important. And so with this graphic, we explained that it's our job to assemble all kinds of and colors of money from the federal government and from state resources and package them and turn them back around and get them out on the street so that developers and community groups can use them to build and preserve housing. This is a little less interesting display of the range of resources, but the big ones I want to call to your attention are the federal tax credits. I think Martha McLennan spoke about those. And there's a set of grants called the Home Investment Partnership Grants that we get from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. So those resources come to our agency, and we in turn then send them back out the door to nonprofits and private sector developers. At the state, we have, and you've heard heard about these, the document recording fee, the public purpose charge actually helps fund some housing. A small piece of that comes to the agency for housing development. We've been able to take advantage of lottery-backed bonds and the capital that those resources provide. Our agency also is authorized to issue tax-exempt bonds, and we do a fair amount of that in both multifamily and single-family. And then again, the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. There are some smaller resources as well, but those are the main ones. Yes, sir.
If I ask a question now or hold them till later? Is it?
Okay.
Go for it.
Under the document recording fee, mm-hmm. and I want to make sure and track down mm-hmm. to the source.
Yes.
I've heard two different accounts. Is there still a portion of that that's set aside for veterans housing? And if so, is it pooled and how is it currently doled out or apportioned?
Yeah, absolutely. Madam Chair and Representative Evans, there is still, it's actually a quarter of the fee of the document recording fee is set aside for veterans. And the whole fee, the whole document recording fee, has three separate accounts, one for homelessness, one for homeownership, and one for rental housing multifamily development. Within each of those sort of categories and types of funding, we have different strategies to make sure that those funds go out the door. On the multifamily side, and I think I have a slide on this in a minute, we are going to issue a competitive offering of $3 million of the document recording fee that's set aside for veterans to seek rental housing, supportive rental housing opportunities.
So I'm sorry, follow up, please. So you're going to offer three, or there's a total of three for veterans set aside?
There's a total of three right now set aside. There's actually a little more than $2 million, mm-hmm. But we're projecting forward that over the course of this year we'll have $3 million.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I've got a full report on that I can brief you on if you'd
like.
That'd
be great. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. So the kinds of development, you've heard a little bit about this from me earlier and from my partners here today. The biggest thing that we try and facilitate is the development of new multifamily rental housing for low-income and extremely low-income populations. These can be anything from large buildings in urban areas to small group homes or infill kinds of development. But multifamily rental housing is the biggest need, and so the bulk of our resources certainly go there. We've also for many years had a particular emphasis on preservation of properties that benefit from federal rent assistance contracts. So some of you are familiar with the preservation agenda that the department and its partners have had for many years. And so we do have funds that particularly go into that kind of a use. Often our partners bring to us proposals to just buy and rehab existing properties. They may or may not be affordable, but if they use our money, then they become affordable. And then another big area of interest and activity in the state is around manufactured home park preservation and capital financing. So for a variety of reasons, we need to use a competition to distribute these funds. The biggest driver for that is the federal low-income housing tax credit. The feds require state allocating agencies to have some kind of a competition. And this competition has been changing in the last 3 years for a couple of important reasons. And so I want to highlight a little bit of that process for you. Again, the overall theme here is it takes more than one source of money to develop any of these kinds of projects. And so the trick is for us to blend it in a way that's most helpful and accessible to developers. I would say we've still got work to do on that, but I think we're making quite good progress. So it's our job to package and tailor the offerings to these different project types that I've discussed. In the competitions, what we're trying to do is focus much more than we have historically on need for the housing, which, as you're hearing, there's need everywhere, and also the community impact, and I would say the population, the impact that the proposed housing will have on the individuals and families who live in those apartments. This is a pivot. It's not a complete shift, but it is a bit of a shift in emphasis away from kind of a check the box mentality in the competition towards something that is more, again, based on need and community impact. Again, more work to do on that, but I think we're making very good progress in trying to target our resources where they can do the most good. A couple of other things we've done is to try and bring in external scorers. Sometimes state agencies take these processes and we have professional staff do the scoring. We've found that it's been really, really helpful the last couple of years to bring in external partners who can help us rate and rank and think deeply about kind of the merits of competing proposals. We're also trying harder to lean on our state housing council to provide policy guidance up front and then to approve the awards that we recommend that come out of the recommendations of the scoring committees. We've heard loud and clear from legislators. Oh, sorry. Did you have?
Well, I wanted to ask about a previous bullet. This. How do you choose people for the scoring committee?
Madam Chair, we have asked. It's a small community of housers, and a lot of the folks who have the expertise are a little bit conflicted because they may have, may sit on boards, or they may be a developer, and so we've taken advantage of a few retired folks, and then we've been asking our state agency partners at DHS and Oregon Health Authority as well. So it's a little hit and miss, but we think it's a good process. We hear constantly the need for geographic diversity, and so we've tried to target resources in a way that acknowledges the really different needs of the diverse communities and geographies of Oregon. And the other piece here is there's many, many regional collaboratives, regional solutions and early learning hubs and coordinated care organizations, and these other sort of local and regional-based groups have come together to solve problems. And to the extent those exist, and we want to have our housing partners plug into that, and so that they're so that we're making investments of our dollars in concert with what local and regional folks say are their priorities. So all of those are little don't lend themselves to check the box, but we think they're important qualitative aspects of our process. I mentioned the Housing Council oversight. This, I think, will become increasingly important. This body today has 7 members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. As you will recall, House Bill 2442 proposed some important changes. Thank you very much for your support. We're thrilled that that bill has passed the House and is on its way to the other chamber. But I think this is a really robust body. It will get more robust and I think will be a really good place to help us weigh and measure different kind of policy priorities, take legislative intent, and think about how to execute. And so these are kind of some of the key responsibilities we're asking them to take on as we as we move towards a more intentional multifamily funding competition. In this current year, we're going to have actually a total of 7 multifamily funding offerings. We just reviewed these with the State Housing Council last Friday, and I won't read all of these bullets because I know you have other people you want to hear from. But suffice to say, we're trying to sort of, again, this is where these tailoring the different kinds of money, offering them, seeking proposals, rating and ranking them, and then getting projects moving through the pipelines at the community level. And so there is this one in particular that will take advantage of the document reporting fee set aside for veterans. And then here's 3 additional ones. Weatherization is an important but somewhat complicated piece of the work. Preservation, and then what we call gap financing, again, naming would be something we could work on. Yes?
Just want to entertain.
I promise this
will
be my last question.
Okay, yeah.
Last question for a little while, and maybe when we have a chance to talk about the veterans report, this might also be there. But when it comes to weatherization, one of the things that again, out of conversations during this past campaign, I offered a bill that's a starting point, I think is the right word to use. But to look at trying to help incentivize increases, significant increases in the availability of housing in areas that maybe sometimes aren't where builders want to build, by putting in incentives, tax credits, other types of incentives, so that the multifamily structure actually is an energy producing, not just energy efficient, but energy producing complex so that there's a continuing revenue stream that is an added incentive over time to help buy back some of the subsidy costs. I don't know how to make that work, but it seemed to be of interest to both builders and folks that are interested in larger expansion of home opportunities or housing opportunities, something that, yeah, when possible, to that weatherization, kind of a broader piece of not just energy efficiency, but how we can actually produce microgrids for power at the same time.
Madam Chair and Representative Evans, I agree, and that sounds very intriguing, and perhaps I can come talk with you and learn more about that. And I think there's some flexibility afforded with this particular pot of money, and so if there's a way to help mix and match, that'd be terrific. Okay. I also want to come back to this theme of we have this vast network of partners. You're hearing from some of them today. They're in the building, so even if you didn't hear from them in the last hour, you're hearing them from them, I am sure, otherwise today. But this, again, gets to the fact that we know that we are not the experts and we cannot control all the pieces of complicated real estate finance and service provision. And so we're trying really hard to get clear about our role and how to be good stewards of money and offer them so that the experts on the ground can do their good work. Again, it's for-profits and nonprofits, local public housing authorities. Several local units of local government are themselves pretty active in thinking about promoting affordable housing. And then there's the private debt and equity providers, banks, equity investment firms, and the like, and then social service providers. It's a pretty big network. This graphic shows you that of the kind of the scarcity question. And so in the last 2 years, we had a total of 48 proposals come in the door for these NOFAs, these notices of funds availability. And we had enough funding to do 22 of them. Mm-hmm. And so this just shows you kind of that scarcity piece. And you know, there's a lot we could unpack in that, and perhaps another day that would be a thing.
May I ask one quick question?
Please.
I don't believe we have anyone here representing the coast, mm-hmm, but I noticed that none were funded on the coast. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you could say about that?
To get back to you on that. I think there were individual circumstances probably behind the particular proposals.
Okay.
But I have another slide that will be a little more hopeful.
Okay.
And that is, over the last 5 years, I wanted to show you a look at just a dot map about over 5 years, we've been able to provide financing for over 200 projects, about 8,000 apartments in 31 counties. So there's over time, if you look at the long term, you can see that we're really making substantial investments. And then here is just the numbers of these kinds of multifamily dollars that have gone in by county. And we've been working hard to unpack this and so that we can make sure folks are clear about where the funds are going. So there's a couple of counties with zeros, and that's something of interest. And being able to see it this way, I think, is helpful for policymakers and certainly for me.
I would like to request if at some point, mm-hmm, some other numbers linked to this in terms of vacancy rate and dollars per capita.
Okay, great.
That'd be helpful.
Yep.
Thank you.
Very good. Great idea. And then this is by year, so you can kind of see the overall trend of by year, how many units, how many projects, and kind of the magnitude of the dollars. So there's grant and loan resources. Those are a little bit different animal than tax credits, federal or state tax credits. So I didn't want to blend those. And I think it's probably in total leveraging quite a bit more than $500 million. But just even at that, I think you can see that state resources and resources that we administer on behalf of the federal government really do leverage a lot of other money in economic development.
Okay, I was wrong. There's one more question. Sorry. But you really got me thinking about this. So during the Great Recession, which really wasn't that great but was big, were these efforts a part of the recovery package, or were they just a continual program based on available resources.
Yeah, Chair Kingeyer and Representative Evans, we did get some, I'll call it stimulus dollars, came through from the federal government for housing. So there was some of that that would have been in the probably 2010, 2011 numbers.
So when you're planning, do you have counter-cycle investment strategies?
Not to try particularly, to... yeah.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
Yeah. I would be remiss if I did not use this moment at the microphone to underscore my belief that we need substantial new resources. Even though we've got a lot, even though there's a lot of activity, the need, as you've heard today, is tremendous. We think there's a responsible way to do this well, and we think we've got the partnership and the infrastructure to execute well and make a real difference for low-income families. So
in the interest of time, I was going to ask you, I won't, but just so it's in the back of your head, I would love to hear more about your ideas, and maybe Janet can address this a little bit, of the process by which you will gather input for how you strategically set priorities for that $100
million. Right. I would love to talk to you about it. And the short answer is State Housing Council.
Okay, yeah. There you go. Great.
Chair Kenny-Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships. You're hearing from me today with my Housing Alliance convener hat on. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I know we've talked a little longer than I promised, so I'll be brief, I promise. So today was an opportunity for housing advocates to be in the Capitol. There are about 275 folks who have been here over the course of the day meeting with legislators. And we also brought 20,000 pairs of socks to the front steps of the Capitol. We have it all on video. You'll see it on our YouTube page later if you didn't get to see it. So why socks, you might ask? Couple reasons. One is that socks are one of the most asked for items when folks are homeless. So it's an item that's very much in demand, and we've got service providers clamoring for the socks, some of which I think may still be sitting on the front steps of the Capitol. But the other reason is, and I do this myself, because I, instead of buying a lot of Christmas presents, I buy socks in the winter, and I give them to service providers. And I stand there, and I think, you know, do I want, like, baby socks for the kids who are in shelter with their parents? Do I want, like, brightly colored youth socks for young girls who might need a little bright moment in their day? Or do I want the big, heavy wool socks for people who are outside in the cold and rain all day? And I usually buy all kinds. But I wanted to just share this. You asked for visuals, so here's your visual. But, you know, this is important because it helps us remember that what we're talking about is our neighbors. We're talking about our kids. We're talking about our future. And they need houses. We cannot, as a state, we can't succeed. I did this all day without crying. Mm-hmm. We cannot succeed unless we provide people homes. Kids need homes to do their homework in. They need to wake up having been rested and fed, hopefully, so they can go out and learn. And, you know, all these goals that we've set as a state, they fall apart if we don't have housing. We've got workers driving over the Coast Range because they can't afford housing on the coast. We've got folks here from the coast from the Gorge, talking about employers who want to come in who can't find places for their workers to live. We've got folks driving from Lapine over icy, icy roads to work in Bend because there's no housing in Bend. So we have to fix this problem. We know that people are doubled up places. They're camping. The city of Albany is concerned about people camping in parks. We've got folks living on the streets in Portland. I drive by them every morning on my way to work. They're not there because they want to live on the streets. They're there because we don't have any place to put them. Shelters are over full. We can't move people out of shelters because you heard Martha Olmsted saying the money runs out by the third or the fourth or the fifth of the month. We're giving people tents and tarps. That's not, we're better than this. You know, we could do better than this. And we need units. I mean, that's the clamoring, is we need housing units. So this $100 million is exciting. It's big. It's bold. It is a drop in the bucket for what we really need. It is a great first step. We have to do it, but we're going to have to keep doing that year after year after year. We can't stop. So what do you get to do? You're not Ways and Means or the Capital Construction Subcommittee, but you do know the people that sit on Ways and Means and sit on the Capital Construction Subcommittee, and you can talk to them about the things that you're hearing and the needs that are being shared with you. You also will get to hear a lot about, you know, these little tools. You'll hear a couple today. You know, can we make sure that tenants get notice when their units are going to no longer be affordable? Can we make sure that we're not taking away the little tiny bits of property tax exemption that help keep units affordable as people are saving for homeownership? So you can say yes to all of those, and I would urge you to say yes to as much as you can say yes to. And definitely talk to those Capital Construction Subcommittee members and say yes to these bonds. So thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Do you have a question? Comment? Yes, comment. So I just, I love the Sox. But, you know, we have had an incredibly mild winter. We know that. We've set records with that. But I am associated with a couple of nonprofits that have shelters, and I can tell you our shelter numbers are high. Mm-hmm. And they're higher than they were last year when we were in the ice. So it doesn't an argument that the weather is good, so things are bad. It doesn't work.
It means that maybe fewer people are dying, but people are still dying on the
correct.
Street.
Yeah, so it is just, it remains a huge issue. And as it's getting rainy out there today, we're going to see the rains and we're going to see those things. So I just applaud the work of everybody in the room that recognizes that this need is huge and that we need to continue to rally and rally the call that, again, in my law enforcement career, one thing that just really resonated with me was when my police officers were dealing with homeless people and trying to send them home. You know, they're homeless for a reason, and that's because mm-hmm. they don't have homes. Mm-hmm. So it just continues to resonate with me, and the work that you all do is just fabulous. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I just have one question.
Quick comment. I want to make sure we have enough time for all the other people in the room here.
I just wanted to clarify something, and perhaps I missed it, is that with the $100 million, what need will that meet? How many housing, houses, families, units, whatever, and then what continues to be the unmet? You had the unmet there nicely, but what...
So
how much does the $100 million chip into that, please?
Chair Kenegeyer and Representative Taylor, we've seen ranges from 1,000 units could be produced with that to 10,000 units.
Oh.
And it depends on what kind of assumptions you make about the cost of the construction, about the rent levels you want to use, about how you leverage it, about all kinds of things go into the mix. I've been using a walking around number of 5,000 units. And what I can share with you is that when we look at the numbers of families who are extremely low income and rent burdened, it's 50,000 needed units to fill the gap. So you can slice and dice all kinds of numbers to look at need, but how many families are severely rent burdened, that number is 50,000 statewide. So if you got 5,000, it's not like you're going to mess up the rental market. So,
thank you.
So we can solve it in 10 years at that rate.
There you go. Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the informational meeting, open a public hearing on House Bill 2629. Could we please have a summary?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2629 directs rental property owners to provide one-year notice of loan maturity to tenants, local housing authority, and relevant Oregon Housing and Community Services Department. Has no revenue impact, may have a fiscal impact statement not yet issued. There is no subsequent referral.
Great, and we're having Representative Ann Leininger kick it off.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Representative Ann Leininger. I represent Lake Oswego in Southwest Portland, and I'm really excited to be here in support of House Bill 2629, which is a bill that has been developed by a lot of the wonderful people in this room. And so I'm just briefly going to describe it, and then hopefully you'll have a chance to hear from Rob Prash and some others who can tell you even more about it. But the gist of it is there are 200 properties roughly in the state of Oregon, all around the state of Oregon, that were built with subsidy from the federal government, from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, Office of Rural Development, and in exchange for really affordable construction funding and deep subsidy, the owners of the buildings promised to keep the rents at a very, very affordable rate for a certain period of time. And in the next 10 years, about three quarters of these apartments, and there are about 6,300 apartments total in these 200 properties, but three quarters of these 6,300 apartments are going to kind of age out of the affordability requirements that enable them to be affordable to people who, seniors, people with disabilities, working families, some of the very most low-income people in the state have wonderful housing because of this program. And so the bill's goal is to provide some advance notice both to the tenants, who typically get about $800 in monthly rent subsidy from the federal government as part of this deal, so they can afford their units, so that these tenants can start planning what the heck to do in the event the apartment building is sold and goes to market rate. And it's also, the notice requirement gives local nonprofits and housing authorities a chance to try to assemble the money so that they, in a willing buyer, willing seller transaction, can buy the property and keep it as affordable housing. When I was at the Meyer Memorial Trust long ago, when I was in Clackamas County, we were dealing with the fact that really important affordable housing stock in Oregon and around the country is facing this aging out of affordability constraints, and we must preserve it because it's so much cheaper to preserve existing affordable units, even if you rehab them, than it is to build new. So this is part of a strategic, cost-efficient effort to do what we can to preserve crucial, affordable housing that serves the most vulnerable people in Oregon. And I hope you'll give it your support when you get the fiscal, which should be, you know, pretty much nothing, but take their word for it.
Okay. Okay.
So thank you,
Representative Leininger. I am going to encourage us to hold off on questions to her because we're going to have other people talk about it, and you know where to find her in this building. We have two bills that we're going to hear that have roughly 15 minutes each, and then we're trying to save 25 minutes for the LURC report. So,
ma'am,
unless you're burning.
Well, if, as long as someone else is going to answer the what the Dash 5 does.
Okay. We'll let somebody else answer that.
As long as there's someone who will answer that.
We will trust someone else will answer that, or else we'll find you.
Okay.
So I will call up Rob Prash, Justin Burry, and Peter. Oh yeah, Peter Hanley. If you could aim for 2 minutes each, that would help us each of these bills to about 15 minutes.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and the members of the committee. Thank you, Representative Leininger, for your introduction. My name is Rob Prash. I'm the Preservation Director with the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. NOAA provides affordable housing lending across the state. I was hoping to take a few more minutes than Peter and Justin promised to be very brief.
But you can have some of my time.
But I do want to make sure that we...
It's great collaboration.
I do want to make sure everybody understands what this bill does. It's actually quite simple. As Representative Leininger noted, there are approximately 200 properties built with direct financing from rural development here in Oregon, 6,300 affordable apartments. Around 4,700 of these apartments come with project-based rental assistance. And the rental assistance through RD is similar to HUD Section 8. Residents pay 30% of their adjusted income towards their rent, and the government makes up the difference. Right now, thousands of extremely low-income Oregonians depend on this rental assistance to help pay their monthly rent and utility costs. Roughly two-thirds are senior or disabled households, and many living on fixed incomes. And the average monthly income for a rental assistance household in the state here is $828 a month. That's $828 a month. It's not very much. Over the next 10 years, well over 50% of the rural development properties will make their final payments on their mortgages. And when the final payment on that mortgage is made, the use restrictions expire and the project automatically becomes market rate rental. That's not the whole story, though, because when the RD mortgage matures, the rental assistance associated with the property is terminated. And currently there are no protections whatsoever for the residents that are affected by that. So when RD exits the property, the residents become responsible for the entire monthly rent and utility payment. We're here to talk about this because currently there's no law requiring owners to inform their residents about the loss of their rental assistance when the loan pays off. And it's this lack of advance notice that exposes some of our most vulnerable residents to significant rent increases with little warning. And could place many of them at risk of displacement or even homelessness. And communities where these properties are located have no advance knowledge that this is going to occur, so they cannot participate in the efforts to preserve the property and help residents secure alternative housing. So 2629 does three things. First, the bill would require owners of RD properties to provide one-year notice to their residents, advising them of the date the loan will mature and their rental subsidies will be terminated. The owners also have to inform state and local government at the same time. Second, it would require owners to inform any new residents moving in during that last year of the RD mortgage of the date that last mortgage payment is going to be made, and the rent subsidies will be terminated. That way they're not surprised, right? And third, in the event an owner fails to provide that notice required under the bill, the tenants would be held harmless with their rent being frozen until that one-year notice period had been complied with. The owner has, if they provide that notice, they have no further obligation whatsoever. And just want to emphasize that if an owner fails to provide the notice under the bill, the only protection the bill would be given to those residents under the bill would be to freeze the tenant's rent payment until that notice period had been complied with. It's not the intent of this bill to supersede the legal right of a landlord to initiate a for-cause eviction during the period a resident is protected. Keep in mind also that landlords routinely provide all sorts of notices throughout the year. This is not a burden. It's part of doing business. So just to summarize, the one-year notice required under the bill would provide residents just a modest amount of time?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Do you want to briefly say what the Dash 5 does?
I'm sorry?
Do you want to briefly say what the Dash 5 amendment does?
Yes, exactly. That was the last thing. The Dash 5 was to clarify that the bill would not supersede the landlord's right to evict a tenant.
Yes.
Thank you.
Quick question.
Yeah.
The Dash 5, to my understanding, compared to the original bill, also clarifies that instead of certified mail, that for regular first-class mail would be sufficient for delivery of notice.
That's correct. There's been five amendments, and some of those were as a result of USDA, our rural development, providing some input to Representative Leininger's office. Mm-hmm. So.
Thank you for your work on this.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Justin Burry, Executive Director for the Community Alliance of Tenants, and I'd like to express support for HB 2629 to require owners of RD rental properties to provide low-income tenants one-year notice that rental subsidies will expire. We've at the Community Alliance of Tenants have been working with Rob as well and NOAA under the Preservation Project, notifying tenants that are at risk of losing the Section 8 property subsidy and letting them know about what types of options they have in order if the property is sold to a nonprofit or if it does go to the private market, they have access to enhanced vouchers so that they can use those vouchers to find housing elsewhere. And so what we find is that notice period is really what allows us to work with those tenants so they don't freak out and move out immediately or take some kind of bad decisions that might jeopardize their housing. Unfortunately, with RD developments, there aren't those kinds of backup resources for tenants. And so this type of notice is even more important. If you think about the areas in which a lot of these developments are, are. There simply are not a lot of rental housing opportunities within the area because they are rural and they are remote. And so in order to be able to, for the tenants to be able to obtain housing within a reasonable amount of time, it might take a little bit longer because there are so few options. Mm-hmm. And so those options might be 20, 30 miles away just because of the lack of housing. And so, you know, when you think about that, these are workers that are the lifeblood of our rural communities. And if the community loses those farm workers, then the entire community can be compromised and have consequences. And so it's just a little bit of information I was telling you earlier about proper documentation and communication between the landlord and the tenant. This kind of guides us towards that, and I appreciate your time to let me speak.
Thank you very much. Peter.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, Peter Hanley, Executive Director, CASA of Oregon. There's a couple pieces in the packet. One is from the Housing Authority of Klamath County, which is working on a property right now that is falling into this little trap of needing some notice to the residents to give them some time. We're working with them to try and preserve that project. In our work, I think one of the keys is to manage expectations when you have residents in situations like this. And to the extent we can give that advance warning, that's a really important thing to help us do our work. That stands for whether it's a permanent relocation or a temporary relocation. Letting them know well in advance of what's going on is really important. I think the second thing we want, it's not unusual for the legislature to take actions like this. When manufactured housing parks were closing, the legislature took action to make sure that residents have proper notice in the event that the park is closing. So I would encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Kenny Geyer. Chair Kenny Geyer. So I understand the process here is to get advance notice so that we can help the low-income housing units for the housing companies that have used the rural development or the Farm Service Agency to obtain loans to build low-income housing. I also noticed that there's an emergency clause, so it's effective on passage. In order to encourage more developers to use these types of programs, wouldn't it be appropriate to also give them 1 year notice, or in effect have a 12-month time for them to come in compliance with this, so we encourage more housing development units to go and utilize these to be encouraged to provide this type of housing? It seems a little bit one-sided that the companies that are willing to develop these types of housing, we want to encourage them and give them fair notice. I'm not sure I see that on this side.
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, that is, you know, I think you're looking at the first version of the bill, but the emergency clause was removed so that owners were not caught off guard. One of the other problems that we're facing is that rural development has not made the information available about which projects specifically are coming to the end of their mortgage terms. So we're working with the state office. We're also working with Senator Merkley's office. And to be honest, most of the information that we've gotten has come through Senator Merkley's office rather than from the state office here.
Thank you very much. We've got one more speaker on this, Michael Van Dyke.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Van Dyke, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors today. I will keep my comments very short and just let you know that we appreciate the proponents working with us on the language of the bill, specifically the -5 amendments, and we are neutral on the bill with the -5 amendments. And with that, I will close my testimony.
Great. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you
for your working on this.
Thanks.
Okay. I am going to close the public hearing on 2629 and open the public hearing on 3082. Can I have the summary of the bill, please?
Thank you, Chair. This bill provides an alternate definition of low income for use relating to housing, directs the governing body to designate use of standard or alternative definition of low income, and allows governing body to change the elected definition of low income. It takes effect 1 day after signing died, and then sunsets June 30, 2027.
Is Lou Frederick here? Okay. Then I would like to call up the first witnesses, John Miller, Kate Allen, and Val Valfrey.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3082 today. My name is John Miller, and I'm Executive Director of Oregon Opportunity Network, the statewide association of affordable housing and community development nonprofits. We know that access to safe, decent, affordable housing provides the stability required for long-term success. Families who have stability in their homes are healthier, they contribute to local economies, they're able to build family financial strength, and their children are able to succeed in school. HB 3082 supports family housing stability. It revises statute to provide another local option under which jurisdictions can choose to exempt nonprofit housing from property taxes. This will provide stability for the families with low incomes whose income rises slightly during their tenancy. It provides them a smooth transition rather than a cliff as they work towards homeownership or private market housing. Specifically, this bill allows local jurisdictions newly adopting ORS 307.540 to elect either a 60% median income cap for residents or to allow incomes of existing residents to rise above 60% area median income, but no higher than 80% of area median income. It allows, but does not require, local jurisdictions who are already using the statute to choose to allow incomes of existing residents to rise above 60% AMI, but no higher than 80% AMI. Or they can simply continue to do it the way they've already been doing it and leaving it at 60% AMI. Finally, the bill requires reauthorization of the entire tax exemption when it expires in 2027. In short, HB 3082 creates an additional option under which jurisdictions can provide nonprofit housing residents with a property tax exemption that's consistent with the jurisdiction's affordable housing goals and that is consistent with the value of keeping families stable in their homes as they work towards home ownership and self-sufficiency. Following me, you'll hear from some of our other members and partners offering brief testimony in support of this bill. Thank you very much for your time and the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Thank you. Before you start, I just want to check on Representative Frederick's availability. Would you like to go now? Are you rushing off to another hearing?
They have more to say than I do, but I would, if you don't mind me just saying a couple quick words.
Why don't you switch with John? You two can stay. You can stay up there. Welcome.
Thank you very much. State Representative Lou Frederick, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. That's important. North and Northeast Portland is important for me to say that because what we've seen in North and Northeast Portland over the last 50, 60 years has been a real, it is the poster child for gentrification. Affordable housing problems, all of those things have taken place in that district. And in my district, I have, however, a group called PCRI. I think you've already heard from Maxine. Is she here?
Maxine's not here today, but Debbie was here.
Debbie was here. That's great. They've come up with a number of ideas, and this is one of those ideas. And I was more than willing to help them bring this forward to the legislature, because the issue for me is a wide range of people living in my district. I'm not interested in just having the McMansions or just the super low income Section 8 housing issues. I want to have a range of folks living around me. I've always liked that. And I think that helps the whole community when that's the case. So anything we can do to help with that is okay with me, and I want to try to support these folks here. They have the details, I do not, so I'm not going to even attempt to say that I understand everything that they're working on, but it's something that I'm trying to support.
So in that case, we will spare you any questions. Representative Frederick, thank you for coming and bringing this bill to us.
Appreciate
it. We'll turn it right over.
Good afternoon. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, thank you, Representative Frederick, for being here with us. My name is Kate Allen. I'm here today on behalf of PCRI. Maxine Fitzpatrick, the executive director, was scheduled to be here and provide this testimony, and she was unable to come, so she sends her good wishes. I'm also have Debbie Christensen with PCRI here, who can provide some additional information if we need it. I'm pleased to be here on behalf of PCRI to provide testimony in support of House Bill 3082. Debbie spoke with you briefly previously about the importance of homeownership and the effectiveness of programs that PCRI and other organizations provide to assist families to achieve those goals. By adopting this small change to statute, you will allow local jurisdictions to remove a barrier that currently exists for nonprofits whose residents are ready to move up and out of affordable housing. John described the details and effect that adoption of House Bill 3082 would have. I'd like to let you know the difference that this can make in the lives of the families that PCRI and other organizations serve. Debbie talked about PCRI's unique mix of affordable housing in the north and northeast neighborhoods of single-family homes, small plexes, and small multi-unit apartments that represents one of the last stable opportunities for low-income households, particularly African Americans, to remain in their historic north and northeast Portland neighborhoods. PCRI rental homes and apartments are woven into the fabric of north and northeast neighborhoods and are a model for eliminating concentrations of poverty. Included in that portfolio are 371 single-family rental homes that are uniquely suited to preparing families to move forward, from stabilizing in affordable housing to working through the steps to become homeowners. Over the several years that it will take for the family to participate in home buying classes, strengthen their credit score, be pre-qualified for their loan, and search for a home, we expect that their household income will stabilize and rise so that they can save a down payment along with matched savings programs. Under the existing rules, if this family's income rises even $1 over 60% of area median income, which is currently $41,000 for a family of four in Multnomah County, that rental home no longer qualifies for the nonprofit affordable housing tax exemption. And the nonprofit receives the property tax bill. Because of rapidly escalating property values in the neighborhoods where PCRI is working, that bill can be as high as $4,000 or $5,000 for one rental unit. PCRI cannot raise the rent enough to pay that, and nor are they inclined to do that because that works against the self-sufficiency goals that I just described. This means that PCRI must pay the property tax bill from resources that could otherwise support a household through the homeownership process or provide other self-sufficiency programs to move up, up and out. You have uploaded onto the legislative information system a one-page flyer that describes some of the family stories of folks who have been PCRI renters and have moved on to become homeowners. I'd encourage you to take a look at that. As Commissioner Bill Hall from Lincoln County previously pointed out, jurisdictions across the state that are experiencing rapid growth, low market rate rental vacancy, and displacement pressures on their affordable rental housing want nonprofit housing providers to assist families to stably transition from market housing into home ownership or be able to buy to afford market rate housing. House Bill 3082 is a step towards the creation of more inclusive, stable communities. And both jurisdictions and community organizations have also voiced their support, and you should have those available. And that's groups as diverse as Portland and Multnomah County, Washington County, Lincoln County, and community organizations like the Urban League of Portland and the Living Cully Coalition of Partners. I want to, in conclusion, I want to strongly urge your support for House Bill 3082, commend your work to assure that all Oregonians have access to housing they can afford, to be able to move up and out of subsidized housing, and please help us provide them with the support they need to do that. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. My name is Val Valfrey. I serve as the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Washington County. I also serve as a board member on Oregon Opportunity Network, and I serve on the State Housing Council. Today, I speak to you from a Washington County perspective. Washington County joins other affordable housing advocates and local jurisdictions in support of House Bill 3082. It is an adjustment to current law that is needed to provide local communities flexibility and to make sure that families that are close to housing stability can continue on that successful pathway. In Washington County, we believe that families and children prosper when they, in life and at work and at school, when they have access to the stability of a home. As a result, Washington County in 2010 adopted the nonprofit affordable housing tax exemption to increase the availability of stable, affordable housing for low-income families and children. While this exemption has been successful, low-income families that currently work hard to earn a livable income can easily exceed the 60% area minimum income threshold, currently at $41,600. For a family of four that would qualify a unit for an exemption. Instead of encouraging or rewarding a positive work ethic, these families are often displaced into the accelerating high rents of the private market and the loss of family housing stability. Instead of displacing families who have succeeded in moving out of poverty but now earn over the 60% threshold, Washington County supports offering a smoother transition for those families to move towards home ownership and towards private market housing by offering jurisdictions an option to increase the threshold up to 80% area minimum income, which is still only $55,500 for a family of four. As you have heard from Oregon On, its members, and from other counties, House Bill 3082 provides an important tool for local jurisdictions in their efforts to support increased housing opportunity. We urge your support for House Bill 3082. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We've got one more speaker, so I'm hoping that we can get Sam Chase up here. And if you have any questions, maybe you can ask him. And Sam, you can speak really quickly. Thank you. You're usually on the other end of this, so you know what that's about.
Yes, I do, and I empathize. And the good news for you is I have children to get to.
Yeah, good.
There you go. So Sam Chase, Metro Council, and Metro is charged with really helping us manage our region's growth. And we have this incredible quality of life. We have excellent economic opportunity for many folks, but there are many who are unable to access that quality of life and that economic opportunity. And affordable housing is one of the most critical tools that we can have to help deal with the challenges of growth. So we need generally this bill, I'm here on behalf of this, but generally we need all the tools that we can get to help our region and the jurisdictions in our region address these affordable housing needs. So thank you for considering this particular issue, which to me is really a brilliant solution to a problem we've had for a long time. And I am not one who is a fan of raising the income levels that people qualify. So I come skeptically originally looking at this, but this requires that people still be at that 60% MFI level. But it gives them the breathing room once they're there to be successful. We are a state that is founded on giving people the opportunity to succeed. People who work hard should have the opportunity to succeed, and so we shouldn't penalize them because they're successful in raising their incomes. So this really gives them the breathing room that they need. And so I thank you for considering this. I hope you will support it. I'm going to add one other little component here, which is I'm also the director of a nonprofit coalition of safety net health clinics that provide health care throughout the metro area for homeless, OHP, Medicaid, federally qualified health clinics and other clinics. They cannot successfully provide health care without affordable housing. There are just case after case where they cannot serve and cannot provide good health care for folks if they don't have housing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think you're beating a drum that has been beaten many times on this committee. It's a kind of a reoccurring theme. So thank you, all of you, for bringing this bill to us and testifying for it. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3082 and open an informational meeting on the high cost of low wages in Oregon. And as people familiar with this committee know, we go till 5 o'clock, not 4:45. So come on up.
Did you go last?
Would you like to start us off?
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, Vice Chair Peluso, Vice Chair Stark, and members of the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. My name is Rahi Reddy, and I'm a faculty member at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. We are really excited to be here with you today to share the findings of our latest research, The High Cost of Low Wages in Oregon. And it's kind of appropriate that we are doing this now after the conversation we just had about affordable housing. You know, I just remember a quote from the previous speakers. We need substantial new resources to provide affordable housing. Our research today we wanted to talk about is to share some of the core problems of why low-income folks can't afford housing. We began this research project in earnest in 2014. Like many of you, we too wanted to understand how this economy is developing, and in particular wanted to understand the low-wage sector. The Office of the State Economist published a sobering report in 2013 studying 30 years of job growth in the state and confirmed what we believe to be true, that middle-wage jobs are disappearing and the jobs replacing them are low-wage jobs that cannot support a family the way middle-wage employment had done in decades past. In the state's job analysis, low-wage jobs were defined as those that earn less than $25,000 a year for a full-time worker. This translates into an hourly rate of about $12 an hour or less, and in our estimates, over 400,000 Oregonians earn these low wages. So for the sake of consistency, our report uses the state's definition of low wage, though we believe it yields conservative estimates of the number of Oregonians earning low wages. As you will hear today, many low-wage workers are unable to find regular full-time work. So it's even difficult to even make these annual earnings at $12 an hour. And as the costs of basic necessities continually rise, yearly earnings of $25,000 still do not afford families the economic security they need to make ends meet and to avert financial disaster. Our study examines what low-wage work is in Oregon, including the industries that have the greatest reliance on low-wage workers. We also go deeper and ask the question of what are the true costs of the growing low-wage sector to the workers who are employed in these jobs, to their families, and to the state that provides programs that help these workers remain housed and avoid hunger. Are there costs to all Oregonians when workers earn wages that fall below what is needed to afford the basics like housing, food, childcare, and having a small savings cushion to avoid financial disaster? Our colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, and University of Wisconsin, and the University of Illinois had produced state studies exploring the cost to states for providing public assistance to working adults when their wages were so low that they qualified for these programs. We wanted to understand that picture here in Oregon as well. Our report is also unique compared to other state studies, something we're really proud about. We developed our analysis first from available state and national data on low-wage employment in Oregon. And we complete the picture with findings from a series of interviews we conducted with low-wage working Oregonians. These interviews give us a window into the daily struggles of everyday Oregonians trying to survive on low wages and unstable employment. We've been able to weave together together a more comprehensive picture of low-wage work lived on the ground and as well as seen in economic trends. We know this report is the beginning of a conversation, but we also know it's imperative we get a full understanding of the problems of low-wage work. Low-wage occupations are some of the fastest-growing jobs in the state, making the need to understand these issues even more urgent. And we also understand that many true costs of low-wage work to workers, their families, and the state, that if we don't understand those costs, then it's difficult to develop the kinds of solutions we need to help Oregonians move forward. So we're really excited to be here with you today, and I tried to talk as fast as possible. And I'd like to hand it over to my colleague, Dr. Ellen Scott, who can share a little bit more about the interviews that we conducted. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having us today. And I will also cut some of what I was going to say and try to be brief. I'm Ellen Scott, and I'm on the faculty at the University of Oregon in the Department of Sociology. I've done research on low-wage workers and their balance between wage work and care work and also welfare leavers for the last 15 to 20 years of my career. Today I'm going to share findings from interviews that I conducted with 44 low-income parents here in Western Oregon, and it used their words to help us understand the challenges that they face in trying to get by on low wages. And I'm just going to highlight some of the common challenges, such as erratic schedules, lack of sick leave, their trouble with arranging child care, and the frequent job changes and periods of unemployment, all of which make making ends meet on low wages very difficult. The parents that we interviewed were typical of low-wage workers in Oregon. They over half of the minimum wage workers are women. Contrary to popular belief, they are not teens. The average minimum wage low-wage worker age of a low-wage worker is 35. Race still matters in employment. In Oregon, people of color represent 20% of all low-wage workers, and an urban-rural divide persists. People residing outside of metropolitan areas are more likely to be employed in low-wage jobs, and in fact, half of the workforce in eastern Oregon earns less than $10 an hour. And the parents we interviewed worked in some of the most common low-wage occupations in Oregon. They worked in retail, they worked in fast food and food services, manufacturing, and personal and health services. And they typically had fewer hours than they wanted. Their jobs were often temporary or seasonal, and they had unpredictable schedules and non-standard hours. Based on their reports of their hours and wages, we estimated that their monthly gross income was $1,300 a month, shockingly low considering that they were single parents trying to support on average three children. Of course, $1,300 is not nearly enough to cover housing, food, and child care costs for three kids, let alone transportation, medical necessities, et cetera. So it's no wonder that many of them rely on public assistance. All the parents we spoke to, and this was by study design, received child care subsidies. Most received SNAP benefits, and some got housing subsidies. Quite simply, they could not manage without these state benefits. In their case, these are critical work supports that allow them to sustain their families despite earning such low wages. So as low-wage workers, the majority of those that we interviewed contended with erratic employment schedules and non-standard shifts. Makes it very hard to organize daily life, especially life with children. Having flexible caregivers is a requirement in managing this life of erratic work schedules, and for many, finding those caregivers is impossible. And as a result, many of our respondents were unable to take or stay in jobs with those kinds of demands. One example is Terry, who is a single mother of two who worked at a large box store, and she told us they'd say that you're going to have a set schedule, and you'd work that schedule for 2 months, and then everybody's happy, the kids are well-adjusted, and then we're going to change your schedule. Terry was able to manage that constantly changing schedule because her mother was paid through ERDC to care for the children. But when her mother died, it was very difficult for her to find a replacement caregiver. Other parents had regular shifts, but they would have they would fill in with irregular days and double shifts in order to get enough hours that they needed. I will skip that story. The low-wage workers we interviewed typically did not have any workplace benefits. Paid sick leave was something most couldn't count on, and their stories were riddled with the difficulties of caring for sick children or for themselves without paid sick leave or any kind of leave. And in fact, some lost jobs as a consequence of not having the leave. So Tabitha is a mother of two. She worked in manufacturing. She did 12-hour nighttime shifts. Her job was not family-friendly. Each minute she arrived late or missed a day due to illness counted towards a tally of work time missed, and this was difficult. She had a son with asthma, and she did have to miss work sometimes. She ultimately lost this job due to her absences, and when we interviewed her, she had been unemployed a year. She was also not receiving TANF, and she had lost her child care subsidy, and so looking for a new job was very, very difficult. So these low wages, erratic schedules, and lack of sick leave create a situation where it is hard to get ahead or even to stay employed. Job instability, moving from job to job or periods of unemployment, was also a critical problem for the workers we spoke with. And the majority of them had experienced job changes or spells of unemployment during a two-year period we reviewed, and this was for a variety of reasons. Jobs were temporary. They sought better jobs in order to try to make ends meet. They were let go after a period of missed work, again, due to illness or a family crisis, and their jobs were ended due to recession, industry decline, or employers didn't provide reasons. One person we spoke with, Tori, had cycled through a number of jobs found through the TANF jobs program. None of these transitioned into permanent positions, and eventually she found work in a subway, but the job was completely inflexible. She was allowed no time off for illness. She tried to schedule time for a needed surgery, and she was fired. She was unemployed briefly, got another job, and then her mother was hospitalized. Her mother was paid through ERDC to care for her child, but when her mother couldn't do that, Tori had to take time off of work, and she lost the second job. We had seasonal workers, and I'm going to skip over that story and move on to public benefits. So because their wages are so low, their hours often part-time and not by choice, and their workplace benefits lacking, the parents we interviewed were forced to rely on various combinations of public benefits. As I said, all of them received child care subsidies, and they said this was probably the most important thing for them. Even with the subsidies, parents who worked erratic schedules or non-standard hours were sometimes forced to choose providers who were unreliable or who didn't provide high-quality care. But still, finding stable care was imperative for them, and the child care subsidies were absolutely critical to their ability to do so. Simply put, their earnings were too low to pay for care otherwise. Martha, a single mother of two who was a server in a restaurant or a bar, reported, "There's no way if you didn't have state care babysitting, I could afford $600 to $700 a month, $800 a month in child care costs with two kids. I make barely $900 a month right now with $324 of my son's child support." And Mary, who was a CNA, said, "I could work, but I'd be living out of a box or my car, because how do you pay rent and pay your daycare? So I'm glad that we do have a subsidy, so then I can work and do what I'm supposed to do." And I want to add to the critical nature of the ERDC program was made clear to us when we interviewed Julia, and I think you may have heard this through another colleague of mine at previous testimony, but she was self-employed and was building a business, cleaning apartments, and had a very strong, big clientele. Her mother was paid through ERDC to take care of her three children. When, a few years ago, self-employed workers were no longer eligible for ERDC, she lost her child care subsidy, couldn't pay her mother. Her mother couldn't afford to take care of the children without the pay. So Julia lost her child care. Her business fell apart. She had really worked her way up, was really getting on her feet again, and she couldn't figure things out with her kids. There were actually some fairly serious and dangerous things that happened with the children as a result of the loss of supervision, and ultimately Julia couldn't take the job. So wanted to mention that. Let me just conclude by saying that the families we interviewed struggled terribly to make ends meet in low-wage work. They juggle the multiple jobs, they do the extra shifts, they accommodate just-in-time scheduling, they They do graveyard shifts. They're willing to do changing schedules, all of this while trying to manage family life. But the wages that they earn, the hours they work, were inadequate to support their families. Some tried to escape this through higher education. They incurred debt and typically did not get better jobs through that strategy. And they felt that they were doing everything they were supposed to do, but could not overcome the obstacles. The story I would have concluded with more time is actually one of our stories of somebody who moves in and out of homelessness. She really struggles. Ultimately, a housing subsidy came through and she was saved. So I hope some of these stories will help you consider the legislation that's going to be coming before you. Certainly, higher wages would make Oregon's poorest workers put them in a better place. The importance of subsidizing child care and expanding the ERDC program couldn't be emphasized more strongly. And, of course, paid sick leave, or at least unpaid leave that in which your job is protected, is also just a critical factor for the workers that we interviewed. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Chair Kenny Geyer and the members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm the research director for Our Oregon. I also hold a faculty appointment at Portland State University in the School of Community Health. Our Oregon represents a range of organizations, and range of organizations and individuals that care about a range of topics, from protecting the environment to preserving funding for critical services and education. I conduct research on a number of different things, including public assistance and government finances and public health and so forth. So a component of our report is that we received data on 197,000 working adults in Oregon who received food stamps in January of 2014. And based on those data, we estimate that the annual cost of providing public assistance to working families, and that covers, the annual cost is $1.7 billion a year, and that those costs cover, in our estimates, SNAP, the Oregon Health Plan, and ERDC. The data we received from the state, these are summary data by industry, so we didn't get any particular business names, but the industry data are very specific. So, for example, we can distinguish fast food restaurant workers from other restaurant workers. And since there are other data published by the state on concurrent program use, so over a million people were served by SNAP in 2013. 78% of SNAP recipients also receive medical assistance benefits. So when you kind of use the statistics to then estimate the coverage across these multiple programs, and that's how we got to this $1.7 billion number. I will note that I think this number is actually quite conservative. For one, we didn't include housing subsidies. Basically, these are two different data systems that are hard to combine. So housing subsidies are not included in these estimates. I'm sure you're all well aware that those are also a critical subsidy, and there's a lot of money gets spent on those. And then, in addition, there are many other costs that are much harder to quantify in terms of dollars, and including the health impacts of sort of living this kind of like low-wage, erratic lifestyle and living with constant financial stress. It's not a surprise that people who earn low wages tend not to live as long or be as healthy. Before joining Our Oregon, I was an epidemiologist for the public health division, and this is a lesson that you learn pretty clearly in public health, that basically any kind of disease or condition you look at, it's more common among people with lower incomes. So I think the range of policy options that are being considered by the legislature to raise wages and improve conditions for low-income working families. I think there are many, many benefits we'd expect to see from those policy changes. Not all of them are so easily quantified in terms of dollar amounts. But I hope that as part of those discussions, we sort of think about the dollars, and we also think about the societal and family costs for them. So with that kind of brief. Brief spiel. I would welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know you didn't get a chance to show your PowerPoint, but it is in OLIS. Okay. So a lot of good information in there. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah. I'll just say doctor. I have actually three questions. One, what percent of the workforce do these workers represent? Any of you could answer.
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Gallegos. So it kind of depends how you slice it. So about 25% of the workforce makes $12 an hour or less. So that's the and that's about 400,000 people. The roughly 200,000 people who receive SNAP, who are working receive SNAP. So that's about half again of that. So that's just kind of a one-time snapshot, sort of a snapshot at one point in time. But just kind of in general, a large section of the a substantial section of the workforce earn low wages.
Yes, Pat.
So I'm trying to think about the numbers. The N again. You said this was this national data or Oregon data? What I'm also trying to figure out is, what percent of these high-cost folks are? How much of that is paid for by the feds, and how much does it cost the state? I mean, mm-hmm. Can you?
Yeah. That's an excellent question. So I want to make sure I got both parts. So first off, yes, many of the many of the program costs come through federal programs and then are administered by the state. But of course, the funding for those programs come from federal taxes, which we also pay, right? So it's true that not all the – so if, for example, if you were to raise incomes and people were kind of phased off these programs, not all of the benefit or the savings would necessarily accrue to the general fund, but they would represent resources freed up from tax dollars that would fund different programs. So. Mm-hmm.
Representative Evans.
I just have a quick question. I got to see your presentation twice today. It's getting better every time. Very good.
Getting shorter every time.
I promise not to go off about David Ricardo right now, so you can be, it's all okay. But based on your studies, what do you think or what do you know, sometimes different things, that can be done to better support working Oregonians and keep them off public assistance in the beginning? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think this has everything to do with, the slide that you had the privilege of seeing earlier. I mean, that decline in income for most of Oregon's workers since, what are the dates of that? I mean, but what declining wages, loss of benefits, loss of these good jobs, replacement of good jobs with service sector jobs. I mean, this is an economic crisis, and Oregon's workers will do better when we can pay them better and provide workplace benefits like paid sick leave, things that will give them some job security, job stability. I mean, those things will matter immensely to the lowest wage workers that we're talking about. And people have been concerned a bit about the benefits cliff. My response to that is, one, currently the benefits cliff is about at the federal poverty level. It's far below the $15 minimum wage or even a $14 or a $13 minimum wage. For a family of three, it's at about $9.52 an hour. That's federal poverty level. So that's where people start to, and I have had people who I interview say, I cannot take a 10-cent an hour raise because I will lose critical benefits. So there is there are degrees of freedom in there that are very complicated. If we don't give substantial enough wage raises, then people will lose benefits that they really rely on. However, the other piece of that is that's negotiable, right? We have the ability to set those eligibility limits and to cover people who are at different pay places in the wage scale. Sorry, it's the end of the day for me too.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Caluso.
Dr. Morris, I hope maybe you can answer this for me. So I've been told that Oregon has the country's lowest business taxes. That's true. Okay, wanted to confirm that. So how much would we need to raise to bring us up to the average?
Chair Kenny Geyer and Representative Caluso, we'd have to raise about $7 billion per biennium to be at the U.S. average, based on the studies that those numbers come from. Essentially, what there are two independent reports that basically they tally up all the different taxes the businesses pay, income taxes, sales taxes, property, and so forth, and then they compare that to the gross surplus product. Basically, it's a measure of business profits in each state. And by that metric, Oregon is dead last, actually by a long way. So we'd have to rate. Increase business taxes by about $1 billion per year to move just one step up in the state rankings. And to get up to about average is about $7.2 billion a biennium.
Thank you. And follow up?
Yep.
So do you know in your research what percentage of our SNAP population is made up of people who had been working, who had jobs but now don't?
Mm-hmm. So that's a good question. So, you know, again, these are the numbers are sort of based on snapshots.
Right.
But essentially, in January of 2014, and that's the data set that we analyzed. There were about 500,000 adults who received SNAP, and then about 200,000 of them had been working. So that'd be about 40%. But I'm actually not sure if that covers older, like people who are aged out of the workforce.
Gotcha.
So the number could be higher than that if the denominator is lower, then the percent would be higher. But that's kind of the floor.
Perfect. Thank you.
I just have one. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I just had one quick question is regarding the low wage jobs. I didn't quite get what the exact definition of a low-wage job was, but so if you clarify that, and then whatever you consider a low-wage job. So I guess this question is for, Ms. Reddy, if you could clarify what the definition of low wage is, and then what percentage of those jobs are with small businesses. I'm trying to understand, because I'm trying to figure out the difference between the small businesses and larger businesses and who's paying what.
Chair Ken Geyer, Representative Taylor. The definition, we use the state's definition of low wage, which is workers earning $25,000 a year or less.
That's it, just anything $25,000 or less?
Yes, earnings. And at about $12, which translates into about $12 an hour or less. Mm-hmm. And we used that kind of definition and that lens to capture the low-wage workers that we talk about in our mm-hmm. report. And we wanted to stay consistent with the State Office of Economic Analysis. And then I wanted to turn it over to Daniel on the small business question, because I think it's a very
good question. Okay.
Oh, yeah. And I guess just to clarify a bit about Rahi's answer. So, some of the report we analyzed data that are available, it's through a data source from the Census Bureau called the Current Population Survey. Mm-hmm. And so based on that, to get demographics breakdowns of workers, we basically had to set a threshold. So we used the threshold that the state economists used for their report for consistency. But then the rest of the analysis was just based on state data that wasn't we looked at the SNAP data, and so that's based less on the particular wage and more just kind of the family income. But to get to your other question, so most of the jobs, most of the low-wage jobs are at larger employers in the state. I'm just looking at these numbers now. So about half of the, am I looking at this right? Sorry. Basically, about half of the jobs either that pay like less than $10 an hour or less than $15 an hour are at businesses with over 50 employees. So that's the and I can give you sort of the specific breakdown if you kind of give me a threshold. One of the challenges is that it's not always easy to kind of draw the line. What do we mean by small business or large business? But it's the those bigger businesses have a, of course, they kind of employ a disproportionate number of low-wage workers.
So I might suggest a $12 an hour, since that's the number you're using, if you could send that to us. We're going to take two quick questions. Thank you for bearing with us after 5 o'clock. I understand if anyone needs to leave. Two quick questions, and then we've got contact information for you. I'm sure this is probably generating a lot of questions in your mind, and it's great to put faces to names to reports. I'm sure people will be following up with you.
We'll share testimony.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. Great presentation. I have a question on have there been any research or any studies looking at a benefit package rather than a pure W-2 wage on minimum wage, meaning if there is an increase of minimum wage somewhere between $10 and $15, has there been any look at would it be more beneficial to the employee, not from the employer standpoint, but to the employee to be able to say, we want to offer you a benefit package that would include as part of any increase health insurance or other benefits. Is there any data that you have that says that break-even point to avoid the cliff to kind of take some of that benefit off of their taxable W-2 and transfer it into benefits that are beneficial to them, like health insurance, you know, those types of benefits that some employers offer and some employers don't offer. But it would also give a higher incentive for the employer to offer some of those benefits that, that might be more beneficial than just paying taxes on an increased wage. Do you know, can you answer that?
I guess, well, do you have an answer? I mean, I guess my short, it's a great idea. I honestly don't, I'm not familiar with a particular study on that. It's something we should look for to see if it's been published.
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden. We're happy to find studies if there have been studies. The only place I've seen that kind of package idea happen in real life is with living wage ordinances. And, for example, LAX Airport, the airport there has a living wage that governs the airport, and employers are able to to either have a higher wage and provide higher wages, or a package of not as high wage but includes health care as a part of the deal with their workers. So I think it's I've seen it personally in kind of local ordinances with living wage, but I have not seen studies of it in a broader context in a statewide level. So, but I'm happy to support looking for
quick,
that.
Very quick. So in those studies, in those microenvironments, do you find that the employee chooses the benefit over the wage?
So I can respond to that anecdotally from the people that I interviewed. Many of them, at the wages they were earning, they needed dollars more than they needed the health care. So they often said, yes, I could, not often because it's not the majority, but there was a substantial minority of our interviewees who were offered through their employers options to buy into health insurance. Bar none, they all said they could not afford to do it, that the extra 15, 20, 30, 100, whatever it was, dollars were critical. So I think you have to get to a critical wage.
Well, that was part of the question. What is that critical wage?
Right. Yeah, and I do not know.
Thank you.
So, thank you. I appreciate the information. I'm going to push back a little bit, and I don't have as much time to push back as I'd like to, but maybe a comment for us. I do want to be cautious about the information we use. I don't think all of this data is correct. We've got some really good information from our own nonpartisan legislative staff. I would be happy to share with you a report around wages and benefit cliffs and things, and I'm continuing to seek that information. And with no offense, sir, to you, I also have concern about data that's coming to us in light of our Oregon has 7 ballot initiatives aimed at, you heard, we need $1 billion more. Well, those ballot initiatives are here. So I'm hopeful that we use other information in finding this as well, because it feels, I'll just be frank, it feels very partisan and skewed that we're going to have a conversation and use this data to inform us. But there's also, politically outside of this building, our Oregon has a mission to raise over $1 billion in taxes at the ballot. And so I'd like us to be using our nonpartisan staff and our data to make the decisions. And I think there are a lot of important decisions to make, and I'm really interested in having those conversations about how do we get to better wages, how do we make sure that people don't fall off of these cliffs. I appreciate all of that, but I really want us to caution that we use the data that our building provides us, and unfortunately not data that's coming from folks who like have 7 ballot initiatives to raise taxes. I'm a little bit offended by that.
Well, so, it's a democracy. We want to hear all voices.
That's true. That's true. I get it.
LRO and Department of Revenue here at multiple meetings. We will continue to invite them, and I welcome your sending us information.
Yep, I will do that.
Can either be attached to a future hearing on ERDC or anything you want to attach it to, or outside of OLIS, share it with us. Certainly, I think it's really important to hear all voices. You've done a lot of great work, and these are really tricky questions. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I was just going to ask if I could just respond briefly.
I think I need to close it.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
You
feel free to send it to our committee administrator, and we can send any other information. So I'm going to close the informational meeting, hearing. And no other announcements. I am going to adjourn. Thank you.
We're adjourned. You can tell me now.
Thank you.
We're adjourned. You can tell me now.
Announcements. I am going to adjourn.